Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.
This week we have Jeremy Clark. Jeremy makes developers better. He is a Microsoft MVP for .NET, and he has authored 7 courses for Pluralsight, including C# interfaces, a course aimed at giving developers a clear understanding of abstraction. Welcome, Jeremy.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Jeremy, before we get started and into the sort of meat of the podcast, would you just give us a little bit of an introduction to yourself and, you know, maybe talk about how you got started in the industry?
So I kind of lucked my way into being a developer. I was a hobby programmer. So at a young age, I was, you know, fiddling around on computers and whatnot. And I remember my brother gave me a box that included a Borland C++ compiler because he thought I'd have fun with it. So I kind of did some hobby programming, but was not really sure how to get into the industry. And this was back in the day when the current boot camps that are pretty good, or you can find some good ones, didn't exist. And so the tech schools back then were kind of not real great. And I thought about signing up for one of those and went in for a tour and changed my mind because I'm like, even though this would give me a piece of paper, I'm not real happy with what's going on here. So I actually lucked into a development position. I was working at the Disneyland Resort on the communications team. And I was on the user side of a project that was basically unifying all of the calendars. So every department had their own calendar, and we were trying to make sure that they were all the same because, you know, things like when Disneyland opens, it's important that that's the same on all the calendars and whether there's a parade or not and what time it is. So we were in the process of unifying all of that. And in that, I went through and kind of did some prototypes using Access, yes, I know, just to help gather some requirements. And the developer manager kind of saw that I was asking the right kind of questions, had the right mindset. And about a year into that project, she said, "Hey, we have a junior position on the team. Do you want to join us?" And I said, "Yes, I totally do." And fortunately, it was a really awesome team. So small team, about 12 developers, but a lot of senior people who mentored and shared. So I grew very quickly in that environment. And it was kind of an awesome way to get started. I don't know how to tell people to follow in my footsteps because, again, kind of the way my career has worked is I kind of head in a general direction. And I usually don't end up where I expect to, but I end up where I really like to be.
That's pretty cool. So what are you doing these days?
So these days, I'm primarily in the training space, and I love sharing the experience that I've had with other developers. I had all kinds of problems trying to learn things when I was a young developer, so helping people get over that is awesome. I do a lot of traveling and speaking because I love watching the light bulbs go on. When I'm in a room of people and, you know, going through, here's the problems I had, and I see the light bulbs go on, I'm like, you know what? I just changed the world a little bit for the better, and that's really awesome. Kind of the primary way I'm making my living these days is through Pluralsight. And that's awesome because I can look at one course in particular, and there's been 100,000 people that have viewed part of that course, and that's an amazing reach. Unfortunately, I don't get to see the light bulbs come on in that case, so I love doing the in-person engagements, whether it's for 10 people or 100 people.
So what course is that on Pluralsight?
The two main courses that I have right now are C# interfaces and understanding dependency injection. So those are both kind of getting started courses. They are on the C# learning path, and so they get a lot of visibility that way. I have 5 other courses on various technologies, everything from getting the right level of abstraction to your code to how to use the background worker component or using reflection without hurting yourself. So
One of my first technical talks that I gave was on dependency injection. So I'd love to hear maybe an outline to the course, or what was the premise of that particular Pluralsight course?
Basically, everything I talk about are things that were painful to me to learn. And then once I got it, it's like, this is really awesome. How do we get other people past that pain? And what I found with dependency injection in particular is people are introduced to the topic completely backwards. So generally what happens is you're given an application that already has a dependency injection container in it, and you're told, good luck. And so you look at this code and you're like, I'm not exactly sure what's going on here, but I need another one of these. So I'm going to do a little copy and paste and change a few things and cross my fingers and hope it works. And that's fine when it does work. When it doesn't work, it's not so fine. So when I teach dependency injection, I take a step back and it's like, you know what? Let's forget about DI containers for now. They're important. They're awesome. They're magical. But let's understand what's going on. Why are we doing this? What are the patterns and benefits that we get out of it? Let's wire things up manually to start with so we understand how it's going. And then we say, okay, dependency injection container, you can take over this stuff that I don't want to do anymore. But when you understand what it's doing, now you can use it effectively.
So backing up for just a second, should we maybe define what dependency injection is for those of our listeners that maybe aren't as familiar?
Yes. And that's actually where I start all of my talks on dependency injection is what is a definition? And basically, when I do a live presentation, I go through 5 years of what Wikipedia said dependency injection is. And all the definitions are completely useless. So I go by a definition that I got from Mark Seaman, and he wrote a book called Dependency Injection in .NET. And his definition is that dependency injection is a set of software design principles and patterns that enable us to develop loosely coupled code. So I like that because it tells us what the goal is. Our goal is loose coupling. And then we can take a step back from there and say, okay, well, it's a set of principles and patterns, which means there's more than one way to do dependency injection. And then we can start looking at, okay, well, constructor injection, property injection, what are these things and how do they work?
Okay, so where do you go from there? How do you help them understand what dependency injection is about?
Well, I teach primarily through code. And so I show an application, which I always talk about is more complicated than it needs to be and simpler than it needs to be. Because if I were to show you one of my real applications that I use dependency injection in, you know, we'll get lost in communication and business logic and how all the pieces fit together. So I show a one screen application. And generally, I don't put DI or dependency injection in a one screen application, but I say, we're going to use this so we can focus on DI. And so it's simpler than it needs to be. But then I take that one application and I split it out into four separate projects that all represent different layers of the application. And at first, it looks pretty good because there's good separation of concerns. It's like, okay, well, the things that have to do with data access are over here and the things that have to do with the UI are over there. But the application is tightly coupled, meaning that each layer is tightly coupled to the others. And that's basically through newing up the dependencies. So the layers are taking responsibility for their own dependencies, and it ends up creating this tight coupling. And then again, that sounds like, oh, it's not a big problem on this one screen application. But then I introduce my boss. And my boss says, Jeremy, this is great. But here's three things we would like to do. You know, we would like to change the data source. So maybe we're not getting data from a web service. Maybe we're getting it from AWS, or we're getting it from a text file, or we're getting it from a SQL server. We want to implement a client-side cache so that we're not always hitting that data source. We can use some stuff on the client. And we want to have some unit testing in place, which I wholeheartedly agree. I love unit testing. I'm a big fan of it. So basically, I show how trying to do those three things in the tightly coupled application is really painful. And it's like, okay, I could come up with this really nasty switch statement and maybe do some reflection in unit tests, but then I end up with code that is basically non-maintainable. So rather than doing that, I just say, okay, well, here in the view model, which is the presentation logic, I'm going to break the tight coupling between that and my data access code, which at the beginning is using a web service. And so rather than having that hard connection, we can inject that data access through the constructor of the view model. And now it's easy to swap that out for different things. And so I walk through the process of, okay, let's go ahead and swap this out and show that all constructor injection is a parameter on the constructor. That's all it is. It's not like this big scary thing. It's just, you know what? I now have a parameter coming into this. So rather than me taking responsibility for this myself, it's now someone else's problem. And then basically I end up pushing those dependencies all the way up to the application startup. And at that point, do some manual new up and passing things around to constructors to create the object graph manually. And after about 20 minutes, you end up with the same code that you had before. So it's like, okay, we spent 20 minutes doing this, but now it's the same functionality that we had. But then it takes about 3 minutes to implement all of the things my boss wanted. I already have some other connections to data storage coded up. So I can say, okay, you know what? I change where we're composing the objects. And instead of using the one that uses the web service, I use one that uses a text file. And with that one change of code, now we're accessing a different data store. To show how to do a client-side cache, I use a decorator pattern where we'll take our repository that we have and basically wrap it in some caching functionality. And now I can cache against my service, I can cache against my text file, I can cache against any of my other data stores. Again, just by putting my pieces together in a different order. And then for unit testing, because we have the injected interface as a dependency rather than some hard-coded type, now it's really easy to isolate the code for testing. And now I have 4-line tests instead of 30-line tests that have nasty reflection in them. So I found that that is a pretty big wow moment. And then most people understand, it's like, okay, yeah, there's some steps to this, but the concepts aren't that difficult to follow. And then I show a dependency injection container just at the very end, and I show the problem with it, which is basically when I put the dependency injection container into the application, now like two of the steps disappear. It's like, okay, well, I need to map my abstraction to a concrete type, and then I just ask for the thing I want, and then everything in the middle just happens magically. And so I think that's the piece that really kind of opens up eyes, and people are like, oh, okay, now I see what this DI container is doing for me, and I can go in and hopefully use it more effectively.
Today's show is sponsored by Datadog, a modern, full-stack monitoring platform for cloud infrastructure, applications, and logs, all in one place. Datadog helps leading companies migrate to the cloud, transform to a microservices architecture, or transition from .NET to .NET Core. Troubleshoot performance issues quickly and with proper context. See the big picture in the service map, which neatly visualizes .NET services and their dependencies. Easily drill down to see the corresponding traces, metrics, or logs for any service. Try monitoring with Datadog today with a free 14-day trial by visiting dtdg.co/sixfiguredependency, and they'll send you a free t-shirt.
So with that, I guess that kind of ties in neatly to one of your other courses on Pluralsight, your C# interfaces course.
Yes, and interfaces, oh, I have a very soft spot for interfaces because I had a very frustrating experience with it. So, you know, I talked about how I joined this development team, and I will say I was a young developer, but I was actually the age of 29. So my professional experience started later than a lot of people. And at that time we were using Delphi, and Delphi is Object Pascal, and it had the concept of interfaces in it, very similar to C#. And it's not surprising it's very similar because Anders Heilsberg actually wrote both of those languages. So the transition to Delphi to C# was pretty easy later on. When it came to interfaces, I saw this thing that was in the language. I could tell it was important, and I understood the mechanics of it, but I didn't understand why. Why would I use this? Why would I do this? And it was very frustrating to me. And it got more frustrating because fortunately, my team that I worked on believed in training and conferences and things. So they sent us to the Borland conference every year about Delphi. And I'm like, this is awesome. I can go and learn things. And when I was new to the environment, you know, 90% of it flew over my head. But I did pick up things here and there. And I went, I saw that there was this session on the schedule about interfaces. And I'm like, yes, I'm going to sit here for 75 minutes. And when I get out of this, I'm going to understand interfaces. This will be awesome. And so I get into the room, I sit down, and like this big brain person gets up on the stage. I think it's the person who wrote the compiler. And they get up there and they're like, well, let's say you have an iFoo interface and you implement it with a bar class. And I just like screamed internally. I'm like, no, don't give me a foobar example. Tell me why I really want to use this. So I sat there for 75 minutes and came out with no insight whatsoever. So I probably spent a good 2 years before I was really comfortable and understood. And I'm like, wow, this is really kind of amazing. And so again, kind of once I got past that, I'm like, okay, it's my duty to help people not have to go through that 2 years of pain that I went through. And so that's really what spawned started out as an interfaces talk at a local code camp. And then eventually probably 3-4 years later turned into a Pluralsight course. And again, that's one that over 100,000 people have viewed, and I'm still giving that talk. I gave it just a few weeks ago, and I'll be giving it again in a couple of weeks from now.
So what is the sort of, how do you approach interfaces when you're bringing it to people that are really struggling with understanding either what it is or even why to use it? So what approach do you take there?
So I actually start out first with the mechanics of what is an interface. And an interface is really a contract. And I say that with a big asterisk because everything changes with C# 8. And I have an article series that I'm working on right now about that. So basically, an interface is a contract. All of the members that are part of that contract must be implemented by whatever class implements it. And so if I have 4 members in the contract, it's basically, when a class says, I'm implementing this interface, it says, I solemnly swear I will have these 4 members. And from a physical standpoint, I will go through and do the same thing using a concrete class, an abstract class, and an interface just to kind of show where there's some differences there. An example that I use is a regular polygon. Yes, I use geometry because we all love geometry. So a regular polygon is just a shape with 3 or more sides, and each side is the same length. And so they have common properties. They have a number of sides. They have the length of each side. And then as a couple things to calculate, we can calculate the perimeter and the area. So the perimeter is the distance around that. And that's the same for each shape. So if it's a regular polygon, it's always the number of sides times the side length. Now, area, there is probably a weird mathematical way to calculate it for each shape, but generally it's different. So like the area of a square is side length times side length. The area of a triangle is side length times the square root of 3 divided by 4. If we were to build like a base class, we could put the perimeter in the base class, but not the area. So that's kind of the point of that. Now, if I use a concrete class, as a base class, for the area method, I basically have to throw a not implemented exception. And so in that case, if a child class doesn't override it, there's a runtime exception that says, hey, there's no area, sorry. If we use an abstract class, we can actually mark that get area method as abstract, where we just provide the declaration of it with no implementation. And at that point, we're forcing the child class to provide that implementation. If the child class doesn't have that, it doesn't compile. And then kind of the step beyond that is to show an interface where an interface is kind of like a purely abstract class, meaning it only has abstract members. And that's not necessarily a good fit for the scenario I describe of a regular polygon, but it really kind of shows the differences from a functional standpoint. And then kind of once we get past that, now the question is, why do we want to use interfaces? There's a couple reasons I like. One of them is future-proofing. So if I'm coding against an interface, I can code against just the piece of functionality I care about. So for example, if we were to look at list of T in .NET, it implements, I believe it's 8 different interfaces that describe different types of functionality. So it kind of starts at the bottom with IEnumerable, which basically says, I can foreach over you. So there's this idea of give me the next item in the list, give me the next item in the list, give me the next item in the list. We can go a step up from there to a collection where we have the idea of position, but not necessarily the idea of modification. And then you can go up to ILIST and get some additional functionality. I show an example there where I'm responsible for the UI of an application. Somebody else on my team is building the library that I'm using. They pass me an array of customer objects. Like, okay, well, I'm going to take this customer array and I'm going to foreach over it and stick it into my UI. Well, it turns out I'm not really using all of the features of that array. The only thing I care about is the foreach. Can I iterate over this thing? And so rather than referencing that concrete type, the array, I can reference the abstraction, which is IEnumerable. And so in that case, I can create a variable that's of type IEnumerable, and I can still foreach over that. The rest of my method stays exactly the same. But then if the people building the library code say, you know what, this person array, this isn't working because we need a generic list for some other places where this is being used. And so rather than doing some conversion, we're going to do it in the library. So now instead of returning a person or a customer array, it's returning a list of customers. Well, if I'm using the concrete type of the array in my code, well, I just broke it. And now I have a compile time error. I have to go in and fix it, change it to a list, do a conversion, something like that. But if I'm using the interface, I don't have to change anything. And that's because I'm coding against just the one piece of functionality I actually need. And that is, I need to foreach over this. And so it makes it more resilient under change. And so I like it when my code flexes rather than breaks. And then kind of the step after that is more going towards what I described in the dependency injection talk where, you know what, let's create a repository. And it's this idea of, let me centralize my code that has to do with accessing data. And so I can create an interface that has, for example, the read and the create and the delete methods in it, and then different implementations of it. So one that goes against a web service, one that goes against a SQL database, one that goes against a text file. And now I can, my source code can just refer to the interface, that I repository, and it doesn't care which concrete type you throw at it. All of it still works. And then I basically kind of abstract it further and further and further until eventually what I do is I use a little tiny bit of reflection to say, I'm going to decide which one I use at runtime based on configuration. And so it just uses a configuration to have an assembly qualified name for a type. And I know that's quite technical. And basically with that information, you can do 5 lines of code that will open up a DLL off the file system, pull out the type that you need, create an instance of it, cast it to my interface, and give it back. And so at that point, I have 0 compile time references to any of my data sources. And that makes it very difficult to debug. So I would say, don't do that unless you need it. But if I have a scenario where I have different customers that all store their data separately, that is really awesome, because they all get one version of that core program, and each one can have their little separate DLL that has their data storage code in it. And with configuration, now they can just pick up one of those. So if someone comes in and says, well, I'm changing from Microsoft SQL Server to Oracle, well, I don't have to redeploy the entire application. Here's the one bit that you need and the configuration you need to change. And when I don't have to redeploy, that means I don't have to retest. It means I don't have to repackage. It means I don't have to worry about bugs that have crept into the code because I haven't actually changed any of that code. So, and then that kind of rolls in dependency injection, because dependency injection containers will do that runtime binding. It's also called late binding. And DI containers often will have that built in where you say, okay, well, here, look at this, go find this, load it up, and away you go. It's amazing how far you can get in an hour long talk. You can basically start with, here's what it is, and get to, okay, here's some really cool things you can do with it by the time you get to the end. So I know that the people that are attending a conference talk, for example, aren't retaining everything because it is a bit of a whirlwind, but it all seems very approachable. And now it's like, okay, you know what? I can go home and figure this out because it's not this big, scary thing that I thought it was. It's this kind of, you know, there's little small steps. And if you understand those little small steps, it all fits together. So that's what I get excited about.
Recently, I saw a video on YouTube from Lee Brandt entitled something along the lines of "Eye Interface Considered Harmful." What are your thoughts on that?
I actually had a discussion with Lee a couple weeks ago about this, and we disagree, and I'm okay with that. So Lee is saying that having the capital letter I in front of your interface is something that we shouldn't have anymore. And that's actually something Uncle Bob argues as well. He has an article saying, let's get rid of this. And I would generally agree with that because there's no technical reason. And quite honestly, in the .NET world where I live, there are two locations that still have this pseudo-Hungarian notation left over. One of them is interfaces, where we say, you know, I repository. And the other one is when we're talking about generics, we'll have like a T key and a T source kind of thing. So those are the two places where we kind of have that. Now, I still recommend putting that capital letter I in front of the interfaces just because that's the path of least surprise. Right now, all of the interface names in the .NET framework libraries, they all start with a capital letter I. That's what developers expect, so I kind of go along with that. Again, I understand where Lee's going with his approach, where it forces you to name it something differently. And I would say, as long as your team's on board with that, there's no problem at all. So again, there's different things that work in different environments. And I'm not going to say Lee's wrong because he's awesome.
Yeah. And I think Uncle Bob, even though he does say to not use the I, he also says to follow conventions being the sort of the primary thing that you should be looking at. So if your team is doing it that way, or if that's the way that the convention of your language is set up, then you should probably follow instead of going your own trail.
Yeah, definitely. Most of the things that we do have to do with how our team interacts with each other, because ultimately our code does have to communicate with the computer, but anything that compiles communicates with the computer. but it's more important that it communicates with everybody on your team so that everyone's capable of supporting and fixing and enhancing and all the cool things that we get to do in a team environment.
For our listeners who are just getting started or trying to look to level up, do you have any sort of advice or words of wisdom that you would speak sort of directly to them?
I would say one of the best things that I did for my career is get involved with my local community. Just start attending meetups and hopefully have one nearby. I kind of live in a rural town right now, and I don't have any local meetups, and it's kind of killing me because up until 2 years ago, I lived in Southern California, and there were 10 .NET related meetups within an hour's drive of my house. So I'm still trying to figure out how to figure that out. In the meantime, I do a lot of traveling and speaking, so I get to talk to people at conferences all over the country. But having a local group of developers that you know and you can just talk to, that did so much for my career. And it's not always, you know, well, this person helped me find a job. A lot of times it's like, oh, you're using this technology? I haven't used that before. What's it good for? What's it not so good for? Sometimes you find out, oh, you're using the same technologies I'm using, but you're using them in a different way. How's that working out for you? Talking to other developers has been such a huge deal. And that's difficult because I'm an introvert. And I think most developers are. I hate to do stereotypes, but there's kind of a reason why that's true. Introverts like time on their own, solving problems, talking to computers. So computer programming really kind of fits into the needs that introverts have. So even though it's a stereotype, I think it's often quite true. And what I found is that I spent most of my life as a shy person. and I am still a shy person, but shyness is a learned behavior. It's not who I am. So once I learned to change that behavior and actually talk to strangers when I travel and go to conferences and meet different people, it's amazing how much that has done for my career, both from a technical standpoint and just from a network building standpoint. Another example is, like, I don't live in the JavaScript world. JavaScript doesn't make me happy, but I have a lot of friends who are really deep in JavaScript. And so I know, oh, if I have a Node.js question, I have someone I can contact. I know someone who's really heavy in teaching people Angular. I know people who are really heavy in teaching people React. I know people who are teaching people Electron. And so basically, if I can get the elevator pitch from them, as far as what those technologies are good for, if I have something that comes up, I'm like, you know what? I have a resource for this. I don't have to know everything. I just have to know other people that know everything.
Speaking of resources, we've mentioned the Pluralsight. Your two Pluralsight courses on dependency injection and interfaces. Are there any other resources that you might be able to point people to that are looking to get started in dependency injection or understanding what interfaces and the best practices around them?
See, the problem is that I created my stuff because I didn't find any good stuff out there. So I did mention the Mark Seaman book, Dependency Injection in .NET. And that's one that when I was first learning dependency injection, I grabbed that and I poured through it. It goes pretty deep pretty quickly. So it's not just here's what dependency injection is. It's here's the five different common patterns of doing it. Here's different things you can do. And here's all different ways you can do it. And here's some different containers. And here's how the containers do it and things like that. So it's good for someone who wants to take that deep dive. Mm-hmm. So I highly recommend that. There's a second edition that actually came out earlier this year. And that has just packed full of great information if you kind of want to take that next step. For getting started with dependency injection, you know, I have to recommend my Pluralsight course. And then the other thing is that from time to time, I'll also be offering dependency injection workshops. So I am available if you want me to come out to your company and do a full day workshop. A lot of times what I found is effective is I've spent a full day doing a workshop for a team of developers and then spent the rest of the week with them and their code to try to figure out, okay, how do we start implementing this? Because once you start using it, that's how you really learn. So I would say take a look at my website, which is jeremybytes.com, and that's B-Y-T-E-S. And it will have any public workshops that are coming up. I don't have anything on my calendar right now for a full day workshop. I am going to be speaking at the Little Rock Tech Fest on the 10th of October, which is coming up very quickly. And I'll be doing a 2-hour, they call it a workshop, but it's not really going to be hands-on in that case. But I will be able to share all kinds of fun information during that 2-hour slot that I have there.
Awesome. What if people want to just sort of reach out to you or follow you? Twitter, is there any other social media? What will be the best way for them?
So Twitter is usually the best way. I'm Jeremy Bytes on Twitter. And also Jeremy Bytes is my website. And then I have a blog, jeremybytes.blogspot.com as well. And that's all linkable from my homepage. And then if you go out to my homepage, I also do have a lot of YouTube resources that are available, not necessarily dependency injection or interface related, but you will find a lot of articles that I've written because as people ask questions during talks, those always turn into blog articles. I did a series a few months ago on using the decorator pattern with dependency injection and just showing how we could do things like add retry on a flaky service just using dependency injection and a decorator. And it's not all that much code, and it's actually kind of cool. So I have a lot of resources on my website. And then I also have a lot of sort of I hesitate to call them intermediate C-sharp topics because there's a lot of things that experienced developers also have struggle with. And so some of the things I talk about are delegates and using task and await. Task is very complicated, but it turns out if you learn 2% of it, you can use it pretty effectively. How to use generics, getting started with unit testing and TDD. So there's kind of, again, these are things that I struggled with as a developer that really helped me take the step up to that next level.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Jeremy. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
That was Jeremy Clark. Jeremy makes developers better. He is a Microsoft MVP for .NET, and he has authored 7 courses for Pluralsight. Jeremy lives in Northern Washington with his lovely wife, 3 cats, 2 hound dogs, and a banjo.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.